Hi, this is Dr. Mike Chupp. You are listening to CMDA Matters, the weekly podcast of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. You know, earlier this week, I had the opportunity to have lunch with four medical students who are leaders from two different medical schools in one of our larger Midwest cities. Well, one of the student leaders shared with me how their medical school took them through a short course in bioethics during their first term. She said, "You know, Dr. Chupp, we were told you students have chosen medicine as your profession. You weren't forced into this career, you pursued it. So you have no business as a doctor refusing to offer any treatment or procedure based solely upon your conscientious objection, because that is bringing your personal beliefs into the doctor-patient relationship." And then the student said, "Dr. Chupp, no one even challenged the professor, but I just couldn't accept what he was saying. How can I offer abortion or physician-assisted suicide someday after finishing my training when I know it's not consistent with providing good health care?" That was a tough question to answer, and it's tough to hear that no one spoke up to this professor. I believe this stern lecture from a medical school professor is one of many indicators that our profession is in crisis today, and our trainees happen to find themselves at the tip of the spear. Well, joining me today on CMDA Matters is one of our most influential and thoughtful and published thinkers on the conscientious practice of medicine, Dr. Farr Kirlin from Duke University. I invite you to listen in to my recent conversation with Dr. Kirlin as he explains to us what the Hippocratic tradition of healthcare is all about in his brand new book with Christopher Tollefson entitled The Way of Medicine. Well, I am so excited today because I've been waiting for a few months since Dr. Farr Kirlin said he would join us after he released his new book, The Way of Medicine. Dr. Farr Kirlin is the Josiah C. Trent Professor of Medical Humanities in the Trent Center for Bioethics, Humanities, and History of Medicine. He's also the co-director of the Theology, Medicine, and Culture Initiative at Duke Divinity School. And at the end of this program, Dr. Kirlin is going to share with all of you on how, if you're interested in a certificate course in combining theology and medicine, they got that going on at Duke. So he'll tell us about that. Before Duke, he was the co-director of the Program on Medicine and Religion at the University of Chicago. These days at Duke, Dr. Kirlin practices hospice and palliative medicine, and he works with many colleagues across the university to develop opportunities for education and scholarship at the intersection of theology, medicine, and culture. He's got more than 130 articles and book chapters dealing with the moral and spiritual dimensions of medical practice. His work focuses and has focused for a long time on the relevance of religious ideas and practices for the doctor-patient relationship, as well as the moral and professional formation of clinicians and care for patients at the end of life. And Dr. Kirlin more recently joined us as we are launching our new Faith Prescriptions curriculum in a webinar we had in the middle of August entitled A Loading Dose of Faith Prescriptions. And his title for that presentation was Practicing Medicine Christianly. Welcome to CMDA Matters, Dr. Kirlin.
Thank you, Mike. It's a delight to speak with you. Thank you.
Well, this is kind of a bookend, literally a bookend, because last year when you joined me in May, after you had given a great talk in Dallas for our first ever summit with Dallas Theological Seminary and CMDA, you gave a talk entitled Contending for the Practice of Conscientious Medicine and told us at that time in May of 2020 that a book was coming. With the pandemic in mind, not sure the timing. And then now you have that book and it's been released entitled The Way of Medicine. So what inspired you and Christopher Tollefson to get that book out there at this time?
Chris and I were invited to create a one-week seminar in medical ethics years ago. And so for the past decade, we've been teaching a course on medical ethics understood in light of natural law tradition. And as we were teaching this course over time, we realized, you know, this is really seeming to strike a nerve with students. We feel like together we are ourselves getting clearer about what the problem is that afflicts medicine that leads to the kind of moral confusion and moral detachment across our profession, and how to communicate a better way, which it turns out we're not making up at all. We're just remembering and rearticulating to a world that has largely forgotten that tradition. And so we at some point decided, you know, we should write this up into a book. So this has been a book that develops out of a friendship of 10 years and out of teaching a medical ethics course for the past 10 years.
Well, I'm going to say it several times in this interview, but to me, the book is a must read. We've decided it's so important for our listeners and for other healthcare professionals that we're going to make it our book of the month in September. So how did the practice of healthcare become, as you describe it with Christopher, a profession in crisis?
Well, we have, at this point, are a few centuries into what historians and people paying attention to culture would describe as modernity. And a central feature of modernity has been a pervasive skepticism about there being an objective moral law, that there are the skepticism about the notion that there are things that are genuinely good that can be known with confidence. And instead, replacing that, there's been an emphasis on each person deciding for themselves what is good. This results in our time in that constant picture in every advertisement of the idea that it's important for you to be you and not be like other people and break out of expectations. It's expressed in ideas like your truth, as if each of us has a truth that somehow we create rather than us living together in a real world, that we want to understand truthfully and live in accordance with the reality of that world. So within medicine, this cultural phenomenon that affects all of our lives in all kinds of areas, in medicine, it's resulted in a steady detachment from what people took for granted for most of human history. And that is that medicine is a practice that is for the patient's health. It is for healing. And the patient's health is something that we can actually know, that we can develop expertise about, that we can be right and wrong about, and that is genuinely good, whether or not someone thinks it's good. And instead, we're seeing this steady expansion of the idea of what medicine is for, to medicine being for what we call, you know, using quotation marks, well-being, but that language is used a lot, where well-being is understood as a subjective idea that is ultimately reducible to what the patient wants, what the patient chooses. And this shift has meant medicine being involved in more and more practices that not only are beside the point with respect to the patient's health, but increasingly actually directly contradict the patient's health. And that's seen most obviously in the practices that intentionally kill, including both abortion and assisted suicide and euthanasia. But it's more subtly seen in this kind of pervasive sense that medicine is just to provide healthcare services to people according to what they want and not get in the way of that.
Well, as an example of that, it seems to me that now, because of that fact, that HR departments can take over actually the management of what is being called providers, not professionals. And just yesterday, Dr. Curlin, I had a phone call from a distraught woman in healthcare. I won't give any details except that she had practiced successfully for a number of years. And on this week, on her desk was an envelope from the HR department of a university healthcare system that she was being fired because she refused to tick a couple of boxes that had come about just recently, stating that, yes, I will recognize and use personal pronouns, preferred personal pronouns by the patient. And even though she explained that I will use the first name, it's not that I will refuse to use the pronoun, I'll just use the first name. And second, she could not tick the box, I will refer for transition-affirming therapy, whether that be puberty blockers, hormones, or surgery. And so the HR department, not an oversight medical professional body at the university, but instead an HR department, fired her. I think that this is going to become pervasive. OB, you go at length in the very end of the book talking about how obstetricians and gynecologists are facing so many of these difficult decisions because of conscience. But I think we're seeing that none of us are going to escape from this model.
Yeah, that story you tell is, it just grieves me, but it is not shocking. And what it shows is that we have culturally increasingly internalized this idea that medicine is what we call, is to be governed by what we call the provider of services model. And that the services we provide are those interventions related to the body that are not forbidden by the law and that are technically feasible. And finally, and this is critically, that a person wants, that fit a person's truth as they see it or their well-being as they perceive it. And the leading edge of this is the so-called gender affirmation or gender confirmation interventions. They are also, these practices, ones that so starkly contradict the traditional and we believe much more both well, much more reasonable and defensible account of what medicine is for, namely the patient's health, because the patient's health is, and this goes back to Aristotle, it's affirmed by Plato and the Republic. It's obviously all over the Hippocratic tradition. It's all over the medicine in the Jewish tradition. It's all over medicine in the history of the church, in Islam, and for, you know, most of even what happens today only makes sense if we believe that health is a matter of the body, it's a characteristic of the well-functioning of the body that is not something we create, it's not something we make up, it's a reality that we appreciate and seek to preserve or restore. So if somebody found a person who had done to them what these gender transition and gender confirmation procedures are doing, and it was told them that the person did not choose this, it was done to them, not only would we say that's a violation of their autonomy, but we would uniformly say that is an objective harm. It's a profound injury because it is objectively clear that these practices diminish and destroy healthy secondary sex characteristics and make impossible reproduction, which is a central feature of organismic health. It's something we share even with the animals. So the story you just told, I think, is the leading edge of the problem afflicting medicine today.
You spend a good amount of time with Christopher explaining to us about natural law and what conscience really is and what it isn't. And that you can't compare the patient's conscience with the doctor's conscience, and spent a lot of time very good on that. So what are the requirements of practical reason, or C.S. Lewis had a term that I can't remember that you put out there, but describe that for us.
Yeah, so the language of natural law, I mean, sometimes is misunderstood as if it refers to something that's sort of written in the sky or something that is, you know, limited to Catholic tradition. But C.S. Lewis, I think, put it really clearly, which is that he used the term the Tao, which obviously was borrowed from the East, actually. But he said, if we are honest, we all recognize that we believe there is a moral reality. Even those people who claim they don't believe that, if you do something to them they think is wrong, they feel offended. And that's because they believe that there's a wrong or that there's a moral law that you're obligated to follow as well as they. And so C.S. Lewis says, no one can invent a new value in the moral law. We're all living under that, whether you call it the Tao or you call it natural law or you call it something else. And the way of medicine essentially begins with a recognition that human health is good for human beings. It is not good because they want it. Rather, they want it generally because it is good. To have your health preserved or restored is to be benefited. It is to be made better off, whether or not, you know, you might recognize it as such. And it's that reality that makes sense of why when someone is found by the side of the road in a wrecked vehicle, no one goes up there and says, hey, what would you like? I want to know what your values are. What's important to you? No, we immediately act to preserve and restore their health insofar as possible. And we do that because we all know ultimately that it is good that health be restored. That we all know this is also why medicine has historically been esteemed as a profession. I mean, throughout history and across cultures, despite, you know, real differences on the margins, there has been agreement that health is the kind of good that makes sense of us together having a designating a group of people that we're going to invest public resources in and give special freedoms to, including the freedoms, for example, of asking people to take their clothes off and being able to cut their bodies. We're going to give them those freedoms because we need to be able to count on people who are devoted and have expertise to care for us when our health is threatened or diminished. And it's that recognition that makes sense of medicine being a profession. In contrast, the provider services model ultimately acts as if none of us knows what's good for the other until the other tells us. And if the other tells us something's good for them, then we must pursue it. No one really believes that, I don't think, Mike, down deep. Mm-hmm. But we have a growing influence of the idea that it's true, basically the lie that that's true. And that the growing influence of that is pushing this idea that you have your personal values and that if you think health is good, that's somehow a personal value that you shouldn't let corrupt and influence your professional practices, which is precisely what's happening with that HR department's decision regarding the physician.
Oh, yeah. In fact, they told her point blank, you are evil because you are bringing your personal views into this clinic, and use the word evil.
Yeah. Wow. That's really Orwellian and super sobering. But this is something I think that we try to be clear about in the book. And Mike, you and I have spoken about this before, but I'm frequently encouraging Christians to remember this. We also, I think Christians, because we live in this culture, we have become familiar with and accustomed to the idea ourselves, even that we have our personal values and that we have a right to practice in a way that fits our personal values in medicine. And there's a truth in that, but the problem is that feeds into this notion that somehow your commitment to only act in a way that is consistent with your patient's health is a personal value. Or in the case of the woman you mentioned, your commitment to only speak about others in a way that's true is a personal value. Those are not personal values. Those are the kinds of commitments that make possible the profession of medicine. Without such commitments, ultimately, you can't practice good medicine. And I think we need to, and we hope in the book to help people be able to see how to recover this. We need to recover ways of talking among our colleagues and with our patients that remind people that when we are committed to only acting in a way that's consistent with a patient's health, when we refuse to participate in so-called gender transition practices, for example, we're doing that not because of our personal values. We're doing that because we want to be good doctors and we're committed to being good doctors.
I've been reminded frequently by some friends of CMDA that even using the terminology is to surrender, to say gender affirmation treatment, when in reality, we don't believe that there is truly gender transition that can occur. And therefore, we try to use transition affirming therapy because that really is what you're affirming, not their actual gender transition, since we really, in our heart of hearts, don't believe that can happen.
That's right. I mean, if we're going to speak truthfully, the way I talk about it is we're not going to act in a way that destroys healthy secondary sex characteristics. Mm-hmm. And this so-called gender transition, it contradicts our commitment to the patient's health. And it contradicts, therefore, medicine rightly understood. So as a matter of professional integrity, as a physician, I will not participate in these practices in the same way that I will not participate in, as physicians did widely, in practices of forced sterilization, or I will not cooperate in capital punishment as a physician. I will not cooperate in abortion. I will not cooperate in any practice as a physician that, to the best of my knowledge, and in this case, we have good reason to come to that conclusion, any practice that contradicts my commitment to the patient's health.
Well, even the history of frontal lobotomy, I think, is another example of how, for a time period, there was pressure to go a route of treatment that proved to be absolutely have give dismal results and was abandoned. But since it wasn't part of any sexual revolution, it's not like a great deal of ideologists jumped on the bandwagon and pushed it, as we are seeing with sexuality and marriage issues.
Yes, that's right.
You spend a whole chapter on the discussion of autonomy and authority, Dr. Curlin, and rightly point out at the very beginning of your book that abuses of on the way of medicine in terms of authority, paternalism, and authority sort of open the door for the provider of services model. Talk to our listeners a little bit about the balance of autonomy and authority, both on the side of the healthcare professional, caregiver, and the patient.
Autonomy, we point out, it is a good thing. When it's understood properly, it's often deeply misunderstood, and it's clearly deeply misunderstood in the conventional way of teaching medical ethics today. And autonomy is understood in different ways. Immanuel Kant, of course, who's historically a prominent philosopher and ethicist, he thought of autonomy as being a law to oneself. But what that meant was not that you get to make up what is good. According to Kant, if you were acting autonomously, you were following the moral law. You were choosing freely to only do that which you ought to do. Now, that has shifted because of the cultural dynamics I described earlier and consumerism and other corollaries of those shifts. That has shifted in our time to the idea that autonomy means you get to do what you want, whether or not it's reasonable and whether or not it's good for you. The expression of that within medicine has been the way that autonomy has become the default, the uber principle of medical ethics. And that's partly because there's such a cultural emphasis on people getting what they want and everybody having their own truth and authentically becoming themselves and so on. It's also because of that deeper skepticism regarding the moral law and skepticism regarding tradition. That means that if you invoke a principle like beneficence or non-maleficence or justice, you do that in a culture that thinks, well, who can say what's good for someone else? Who can say what's a harm for someone else? Who can say what is justice? And so since you can't say about those things, everything defaults to autonomy, to people being able to choose what they want. We argue that a more fitting principle for the practice of medicine in what we call the way of medicine, which is the tradition that's dominated, I mean, that has made sense of medicine for most of the history, certainly the history of the West, is authority. Because authority, the very idea of authority, recognizes that there are limits to any person's authority. And clearly, in our pursuit of the patient's health, physicians must recognize that their authority is limited in such a way that we can only act on a patient with their consent, that a patient is in the position to discern among all the goods they might pursue, because health is not the only thing that's worthwhile in life, to what extent they're willing to cooperate with a physician in the pursuit of their health. And physicians must honor that. We're not arguing that doctors need to recover this idea that they get to just write orders and patients must obey them,
right?
But that instead they exercise their own authority as professionals, their justified authority in deciding which of the things that are technically feasible in our culture are actually consistent with the profession of medicine and specifically consistent with the physician's commitment to the patient's health. When we determine that a practice, even though it might be widespread, contradicts that commitment, we are exercising our authority properly in refusing to cooperate in that practice. And when we offer patients options as to what we are, or recommendations regarding how to pursue their health, we are exercising our authority properly. But we also recognize that patients can refuse what we offer. And so it's this respect for patient authority, but respect for the limits of that authority. And one of the key limits of patients' authority is patients don't have authority to tell physicians what to do. They don't have authority to demand that a physician act in a way that contradicts the physician's profession, their commitment to the patient's health, and they don't have authority to demand that the physician do anything that, to the best of the physician's understanding, contradicts their moral obligations. So that's the key distinction.
Well, I'm really glad as you concluded your book, Farr, that you pointed out that the way forward for us in healthcare, whether we're motivated by our faith or not, is that trying to declare our rights and our authority as professionals is not really the way to win the day, to win this battle or argument, and that it is really focus on responsibility and really even not the right of care, but the duty of care, which has become so much more clear to me. And we may have talked about it last year during our previous interview, the whole COVID-19 situation and the duty to care for healthcare professionals, even though we put ourselves at risk. Can you just elaborate a little bit on that about our focus here and how we can win the day?
I think the COVID pandemic has been a time where people have been able to remember that what we esteem about the profession of medicine is that its members have committed themselves and disciplined themselves to show up and attend to people who are sick, notwithstanding the other characteristics of the patient, right? Anyone who is sick calls on us to care for them if we're able, insofar as we're able, and that they do so out of a sense, not just that they're obligated, but that they're obligated towards something that is genuinely good. That this work is good. It is good to care for those who are sick. It is good to see their health preserved. So even though it has exhausted clinicians, I think it's also actually re-inspired clinicians who've been on the front lines as they've been able to experience the goodness of this work. And so I think that's a clue that we can pay attention to recognize that when we move into another area where there's a dispute, like whether it's the procedures of changing secondary sex characteristics or it's abortion or it's, you know, hastening patients' death because patients say they don't have anything else to live for. Here, we don't want to shift to the language of, you know, I have my rights, including my right of conscience and my personal values that you're to respect. Rather, we want to remember that here we likewise are contending for the patient's good and for their health, that we are willing to care for patients' health insofar as possible, wherever that's at risk, wherever that's hanging in the balance. But we're not willing to go do things that actually contradict that commitment. And so I think it's important for Christians to recover that language so that when they're talking to their patients and they're talking to their colleagues, they're helping them remember, oh yeah, there's actually an important argument to be made here that medicine is for healing. That's a concept that I've not yet met anyone who doesn't hear that and go, yeah, that's plausible. That makes sense.
Well, as we wrap up our time together, and I really wish we could go on for a lot longer, but I want to thank you and Christopher. I've been waiting for some folks in places like you are at Duke, you and Christopher, to formally, in writing and respectfully, and I believe persuasively, deal with this whole idea of the favored editorialist of Ezekiel Emanuel and Stahl in the New England Journal of Medicine, and this whole idea that doctors are not conscripts. So wake up. If you're going to become an OBGYN, then you're going to have to just leave your convictions at the door. The whole idea of pointing out that the way of medicine is much more conducive and accepting of pluralism than the provider of services model. Just unpack that for us as we come to the home down the home stretch.
So paradoxically, and of course, I'm sure the listeners here will immediately recognize this, paradoxically, these so-called arguments for inclusion and tolerance, or in the case of Emanuel and Stahl, this idea that we're supposed to put the patient's interests first and therefore cooperate with abortion, or therefore cooperate with assisted suicide, or therefore cooperate with destroying their healthy secondary sex characteristics. That idea ends up being quite coercive and quite intolerant and quite narrow. The way of medicine, by contrast, recognizes that although health is really good for everyone, it's not the only good first. And therefore, we're not suggesting that everyone has to pursue health to the same extent and in the same ways. And we recognize that whether a given patient wants to cooperate with a physician in pursuing their health in one way or another, whether they're going to have this surgery or that, or this chemo or that, or whatever it might be, is something that the patient has authority to decide in conversation with their clinician. And we also recognize that on the margins, there's going to be complexity, and there has, for all of history, been ambiguity sometimes about what a commitment to health requires. And so there's space for different traditions and different moral communities to go about healing in ways that differs to some extent from others. And that's why we think that the hard line that can still be a line under which many, many physicians can gather is the hard line of, we are never going to intentionally hasten or cause the death of our patients. Doctors do not kill. That also is something that everybody can recognize as a plausible claim. But within that, there can be a lot of variety and diversity in how people go about pursuing healing and the extent to which they prioritize health.
Well, you wrapped up your book with a great, incredible Martin Luther King Jr. quote. And I think we all need to, almost on a regular basis, be exhorted to be courageous in this day for healthcare like never before. But I love this quote. "There comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe nor politic nor popular, but he must take it because conscience, the word of our day, conscience tells him it is right." That's a great quote. And appreciate this book, The Way of Medicine, that has just come out under what publisher, Dr. Kirlin?
It's published by Notre Dame University Press.
Excellent. We'll do want to encourage our listeners to get Dr. Kirlin's book and also to check out his talk on our Faith Prescriptions curriculum that's on our Learning Center, which is free for our members, Practicing Medicine Christianly. Thank you for all you're doing for the kingdom and for education. And one final opportunity to put in a plug for a course that you've got going on there at Duke. Tell us briefly about your course of theology and healthcare.
Thank you, Mike. We have at Duke Divinity School an unusual initiative called the Theology, Medicine, and Culture Initiative, where we invite people who have vocations to healthcare, including anyone listening to this, to come do a deep dive in studying Christian tradition from the writers of the scripture to the best minds today to understand the world of health and medicine Christianly. And we now have a distance program called a Graduate Certificate in Theology and Healthcare that you can participate in without having to move here. You spend a week here in the fall and a week in the spring, and it's sort of designed for the practicing clinician. So we'd love for you to check that out on our website.
What's the website? Can you give us that
link? The website is tmc.divinity.duke.edu.
Excellent. God bless you, Dr. Kirlin. I know we're going to be seeing you around the block here a few times in coming months.
Thank you, Mike. God bless you also.
We are so grateful for many partners across this country with CMDA, and among them, as you've heard, is Duke University. They've been working with our campus and community ministries, leadership, and working with students on theology and medicine, and that's why I asked Dr. Kirlin to put in a plug for that program. We have made Drs. Kirlin and Tollefson's book our CMDA Matters Book of the Month. You can get your copy of The Way of Medicine just by going to cmda.org/bookofthemonth, one word, and making a donation of any amount. We are so grateful for your support as our advocacy team, led by Dr. Jeff Barrows, they contend for the practice of conscientious medicine in the public square and in the halls of federal and state government institutions. Well, you probably noticed my conversation with Dr. Kirlin was a little longer than our usual interview. So I'll just remind you about a couple of conferences that are happening later this month and in October. Our Women Physicians and Dentists in Christ will host their 2021 conference on September 30th through October 3rd in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Well over 200 women have already registered for an excellent lineup of speakers and worship. There'll be over 16 hours of live as well as enduring CE credits that are offered through this conference for the first time ever. For more information or just to register, whether you're going to attend live or virtually, visit cmda.org/events or just click the link in our show notes today. The 2021 CMDA Midwest Fall Conference will take place October 15th through the 17th at the Maranatha Bible Conference Center in Norton Shores, Michigan. You can look forward to hearing Dr. Andre Van Maal, one of the most prolific and impactful speakers in the country, and one of our CMDA members, on the topic of healthcare professionals and the transgender tsunami. And you'll receive continuing education credit while enjoying the scenic eastern shores of Lake Michigan. For more information on how to register, just click the link in our show notes today or go to cmda.org/events. Dr. Kirlin and Dr. Tollefson's book, The Way of Medicine, is a most timely reminder of why medicine has been such a revered profession for centuries. Our patients and their families trust us to be all about what is best for their health. You know, nearly 30 years ago, our CMDA House of Representatives and our board approved an oath for our members called the Christian Healthcare Professionals Oath. And it ends with this commitment: "With God's guidance, I will endeavor to be a good steward of my skills and of society's resources. I will convey God's love in my relationships with family, friends, and community. I will aspire to reflect God's mercy in caring for the lonely, the poor, the suffering, and the dying. With God's direction, I will respect the sanctity of human life. I will care for all my patients, rejecting those interventions which either intentionally destroy or prematurely end human life, including the unborn, the weak and the vulnerable, and the terminally ill. With God's grace, I will live according to this profession." I love this oath from CMDA, as I believe that it outlines so well the way that our members seek to honor God and serve their patients in obedience to a conscience informed by medical evidence, by God's word, and superintended by God's indwelling spirit. You know, treating your patients for the objective good that is their health and well-being matters to you, our CMDA members. God Himself has called you into this purpose, and I assure you, it matters to CMDA, and CMDA matters. Don't forget to subscribe, and please share this episode with a friend, whether or not they hold to our faith. Let us know how we're doing by giving us a rating and send us your comments by emailing cmdamatters, one word, at cmda.org. I want to invite you to join us next week as we discuss the impact of the fall of man on the physical reality of the work that we do in preventing and treating disease on a global scale. I'll be with Dr. Daniel O'Neill talking about his new book entitled All Creation Groans: Toward a Theology of Disease and Global Health. We'll see you next week if our Father in Heaven wills it to be so. Bye for now.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.